But he's not saying you. He's saying the warning isn't that God is going to punish you for these things. The warning is these things can draw you back into the world, and the world is under God's judgment. Again, it's this matter, are we saved out of the world? We have to retain that. That if we preach a gospel that is salvation from the way of the world,
it's implicit.
We have an ethic built in, right?
Welcome everyone to the Faith Recovery Podcast, where we are seeking to recover faith by recovering the faith. I'm Kent.
And I'm Nathan.
And we're in a series, what did we say this is called? Oh, the voice of the Shepherd. Yeah, we're trying to discern the voice of the Shepherd in daily life. That is to say, what is the message Jesus has for us, and how do we discern it? And we're saying we discern it from the gospel. The gospel is the message, and it applies to all the different ethical challenges we face, trials we face, troubles, temptations that we face. Not to say that Jesus doesn't speak to us something really specific to our circumstance, but it's going to be shaped by the gospel message. And we're going to look today at some passages that illustrate that that's how it works.
Right. Yes, we are, buddy, and it's going to be good. You know, I had to go through this a lot because, as we mentioned before, I really was the super legalist, and we turned the Bible into a legal code. And so when God started peeling that away, and I was trying to understand this notion of salvation by grace, and I had to try to see why he was saying what he was saying, because Paul does have sections. I mean, there's enough material in the New Testament that allowed us to turn it into a list of do's and don'ts.
Okay.
So
there's commands to do this or that, exhortations.
Something like that, yeah. And so, you know, what is he saying, and why, how can it be that we're saved by grace, and then Paul comes through with all of this kind of ethical code, and what does that mean? You know, is he revoking this notion of freedom? You know, did he lead with the idea of freedom and of grace and all of that, but then he kind of does a bait and switch? And by the way, I perceive that that's kind of what churches do sometimes, is we offer salvation on the basis of faith, and we're very intentional about that. We'll insist on it, but when someone joins the church, then we're like, okay, that's fine, that's all well and good, but here's what we really need you to not do, and here's what we really need you to do. And so how does that all work, right? And so as I was going through it, I started to realize that Paul wasn't legislating do's and don'ts. That, and as we talked about last time, this idea of descriptive versus prescriptive, that he's giving them the... I guess the way to live consonant with the gospel message, to live in harmony with what they have accepted already. And so that kind of begins to be a thread as you chase it backward and you say, okay, how is it this gospel has so many implications? It's so significant. Whereas what I was always told was pretty basic and limited. So that there wasn't an ethic really resident in it, except maybe just generally be grateful and maybe on a good day, pay it forward. Mm-hmm. So Paul had a different approach to his own message. And he really, when the rubber starts to meet the road, when people begin to go off the rails and they begin to do things that are ethically troubling, and certainly that happened a lot for Paul, because here's a Jew who's very, you know, trained in the mitzvah, and so he's got his do's and don'ts, right? And he's just marinated in that. And now he's reaching out to these Gentiles who definitely don't have that, you know? And so there's this tendency to turn the gospel into a license to sin. And we see that there were several sects that cropped up, the Nicolaitans and others that John mentioned specifically in Revelation. Paul seems to be dealing both with asceticism, people who believed in a rigor and a harsh treatment of the body, and then he seems to deal also with people who are more libertine And as he deals with that, as the rubber meets the road and things go sideways and all of that, he never comes off of this law-free approach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's really, I think it's really important as we begin to go, and where I want us to get, and where I hope we'll get, is that we can learn how to exposit the gospel into the kind of the thorny issues of our life.
Mm-hmm.
And begin to look at modern issues with the gospel lens, and understand that we have what James calls the perfect law of liberty. So this is a law that's it's dynamic, it's alive, it's always updating. It's not something that's static and becomes irrelevant over time, you know. So I'm sure if you were to read a legal text, say from the 19th century in America, there would be a lot of things about what to do with your horse,
mm-hmm.
you know. And now it's just almost nothing. It's hard to find any good legal text on how to mm-hmm. how to handle your horse in town, and that's kind of just an example of how legislation is static and it just gets left behind. But God is able to give us an ethical standard that is objective enough for us to know how to be led, to go through this very, I think, important transition where we surrender ourselves willingly to a standard. We hold ourselves accountable to something that is above our baser drives. Like, we need that. That we have to, that moral muscle has to be flexed mm-hmm. for there to be any discussion of ethics or morals, okay? And so it has to have that for us, but it also has to have enough stretch in it that as, and enough, I guess, expandability, this ability to kind of proliferate, that it can apply to things and not become antiquated or quaint.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I think that's a legitimate critique of a religious system. And, you know, look at ISIS, people who try to take a very serious approach to Muslim ethical and, you know, legal code. And we look at them and we think that's very barbaric. You know,
mm-hmm.
but of course they're following a code from the seventh and eighth century, right? Mm-hmm. And so that becomes regressive. It becomes harmful. We mustn't participate in that as Christians. And I think that sometimes when we abdicate the basic gospel, what the gospel is calling us into. When we abdicate that for rigorous conformity to a religious text as we understand it, we become similarly regressive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the danger. And that's why I think this series is important, because we want to give people the legitimate New Testament ethic. So people are like, well, I want to be a New Testament Christian. It's like, yes, please do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what you'll see is that Paul was doing something creative with the gospel where he was applying it to life, and he wasn't writing like Muhammad was writing, a code for us to follow, a written code for us to follow.
Well, and maybe even more importantly, he wasn't writing the New Testament,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And so if you really want to be a New Testament Christian, that you must follow something more ancient than the book called the New Testament, because the book that we call the New Testament is the story of people who are trying to follow the New Testament.
The New Covenant.
Right.
Yeah.
And so if you want to be a New Testament Christian, our behavior has to fall in line with what Jesus says there at the Last Supper. And he's like, this cup is the New Testament in my blood.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it seems like it's present. It's already right there in the room.
Mm-hmm.
We're not waiting 337 years, right,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
for Athanasius to finally sew it all together and come up with his canon, right? Mm-hmm. So it's super important for us to be New Testament Christians in the sense that in the actual New Testament and the book. Well, going forward, we'll use New Testament to talk about the book, but at any rate, I want us to make that distinction that New Testament is a misnomer for mm-hmm. the 27 books that were ultimately bound together
right.
as Holy Writ. So let's just jump in, shall we? And I think an important place to start is in Colossians chapter 2. beginning in verse 16, and then we'll go on into chapter 3, and we may just be there pretty much the whole time, because I think that this is a good cross-section of Paul's New Testament ethic.
Okay.
So Colossians 2, beginning in 16, and maybe go through 23. You want to read that one?
Therefore, do not let anyone condemn you in matters of food or drink or of observing festivals, new moons, or Sabbaths. These are only a shadow of what is to come, but the body belongs to Christ. Do not let anyone disqualify you, insisting on self-abasement and worship of angels, initiatory visions, puffed up without cause by a human way of thinking, and not holding fast to the head, from whom the whole body, nourished and held together by its ligaments and tendons, grows with a growth that is from God. Keep reading.
Yeah.
If with Christ you died to the elemental principles of the world, why do you live as if you still belonged to the world? Why do you submit to regulations? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. All these regulations refer to things that perish with use. They are simply human commands and teachings. These have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-imposed piety, humility, and severe treatment of the body, but they are of no value in checking self-indulgence.
All right. So Colossians 2 is kind of addressing this, I think, the more legalistic, ascetic approach. He talks about don't submit to rules, don't handle, don't taste, don't touch. And this may have been part of a Gnostic ritual, but I think it would certainly also apply to the food laws of the Old Testament. And so here he's kind of walking back, if you will, and this is a Gentile church, and he's saying, why are you surrendering? Why are you submitting yourself to these things? And that these rules, they're rooted in the elemental spiritual forces, the NIV says, the elemental principles. And we've spoken about that in the past, the elementary principles of the world. Okay. So my contention is that the elementary principles of the world are the mechanisms by which society controls, the world controls the individual. Okay. So that would be authority, that would be conformity. And while those principles can operate apart from rules, they do a whole lot better with rules. Rules are, it's kind of like, you know, maybe one person can kill another person with their bare hands, but it's a lot easier if you have a gun. Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you think the elemental principles of the world or whatever are the killer, right, or the aggressor, and the rules are the gun. And so these things, when, if you have a set of rules that do not taste, do not touch, and the more arbitrary they are, the more control, the more you get to a pure control of by the society over the individual, because now it's not the individual acting in their own interest. They're just responding to what they've been told. You know, if I can't actually see, I mean, I actually have maybe a draw to that plate of bacon over there, and I really can't see why it would hurt, you know, and they're eating it and they're fine, and why can't I have it? You know, but now I'm being told not to eat it, that I'm responding purely to the rule, right? Mm-hmm. That I can't even see within the rule how it could possibly benefit me. Mm-hmm. You see, and so there's a surrender of the individual locus of control, my own moral compass, to the other, especially as we respond to arbitrary rules. Okay. And that may be important sometimes, especially if you want to keep society on the rails and you just need people to do what they're told when they're told and not ask questions, because if everything has to be a debate, we're just never going to get anywhere, right? But if you want to really set people free, if the goal of salvation, let's say, is to liberate individuals to become fully formed moral beings, okay, then you can't take that approach. They're mutually exclusive. And so that's why Paul's saying, don't submit to this stuff. It's like, don't let this affect you. And so that's one reason. So we're prohibited from following arbitrary moral or religious laws. I want us to get that Paul really, I think, it's not so much the content of the law, because he says, you know, and people will go and say, well, no, we're not supposed to follow human commands and teachings. But again, all of these have come through humans, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, and a big point is made that that even the scriptural, the Old Testament law came through Moses. Mm-hmm. OK, so that humans have had their hands on it along the way. But also, I think that he's talking about things that have to do with that which is in this sphere, this realm, this physical realm. OK, it's not so much commands of human origin, but commands that are in alignment with the way humans do things. Okay, that there's a human realm here. That's why it's the elementary principles of the world. And so these are rules that are in connection with that. Now, so he's pointing us to something more transcendent, esoteric than human commands. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So if I can look around the world everywhere, people control one another's behavior through human commands. Now, even if those claim to be from a religious origin, they're still operate within the human sphere. Okay. So for instance, if you violate Sabbath in a Jewish community, that there are human consequences, you know, there are human observers and there are human consequences. And even though you may say, well, Sabbath came from God originally, it's the mechanism of surrendering by rote to an instruction, regardless of the source, that is the problem. Okay. And it gives power to the society, even if the society is a religious society. And so that's a problem. It's problematic, and it retracts the salvation that we've been given. Okay. So he says such regulations indeed have an appearance of wisdom, which is why they're so tempting. You know, like, you know, you're having someone's having a problem with lust, right? And they just decide, you know, I'm going to wear blinders, you know, or whatever. So it looks like that's fixing the problem, right? But it doesn't. And so that's what he's saying is that these things look like they're helpful. You know, like the whole rubber band you put on your wrist, you snap yourself every mm-hmm. time you need to remember to do a thing, right? Mm-hmm. It looks like it's helpful. But he said, no, it that doesn't do anything if your goal... And this gets to the goal, right? Restraining sensual indulgence. He's like, look, you ascetics, you legalists, you have a desire. You know that your lusts will destroy you. You know that. And guess what? I do too. Right? So we're not in disagreement over the danger of unchecked physical or psychological cravings. Both of us understand that. What we disagree over is the means of overcoming them. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just kind of breaking down what he says here, but I think it's really important to begin in chapter 2 because he's precluding the idea of a rule-based approach to moral improvement. Okay? And he's saying that, and he's like, look, I understand the drive. I know why you want to do it. I know why it's tempting. But the problem is that you've died to the elementary principles of the world. And that's what he said back in, where was it, verse 14 or something. But, you know, he says since you've died to the principles of the world, why are you doing this? Verse 20. You died with Christ to the elementary, I would say, principles of the world. Why, as though you still belong to the world, do you submit to its rules? Okay. So I think that's kind of a cornerstone. That's a foundational statement as far as what is salvation. Okay. So we died to the elementary principles of the world by dying to the world. Okay. So we can't go back there and audit the methods and the operating system of this world. We have to find an ethic that is rooted and planted above this world, which is where he goes next. 3:1. Since then you have been raised with Christ, set your hearts on things above where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things. For you died, and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will also appear with him in glory. I'll stop right there for a minute. How do you hear that when you...
Well, I noticed that the previous section said, if with Christ you died, mm-hmm. and this section says, so if you have been raised yeah. with Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not looking for the worldly methods. We're looking for the heavenly methods, because we've died with Christ to the world, and we're raised with Christ.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So in Ephesians, Paul talks about that we died with him, we've been raised with him, we've been seated at the right hand of God, right? Ephesians 1. In Romans 6, he talks about Jesus. He died and he rose, and now the life that he lives unto God, right? Mm-hmm. And then he says, now you were baptized, and when you were baptized, you died to this world, and you've been raised to live a new life. And this life is unto God, right? That there seems to be a new ethic that responds directly to God and not to the mediating rules or the society connected to them. And so I think that's what Paul's suggesting, that there is this, what really must be an internal shift. So there's this, what he's saying is leave behind this kind of shell, this scripted life, and instead begin with your mind, right? Because he's saying, look, you were following human commands, things according to the flesh, okay? But now I want you to shift to something no one can observe. I want you to go to a very private place, you know? Go before God, and Jesus says, you know, when you pray, go into your room, go in secret to the one who sees in secret. So God's invisible, right? Go and have an invisible encounter with him. Let your encounter with him be in that secret place of your mind and your heart first. And let it change what you pursue, what you're seeking. Paul would suggest that the everything is about the pursuit. And if what I'm pursuing is this new world coming, right? It's a very forward-looking ethic, right? And so there's this, if I allow myself to desire God and to pursue him, to pursue fellowship with him, relationship with him, if I lose sight of not only the appeal and the demands and the desires of this world, but also my fears, my anxieties over its temptations and over its destructive potential. Because I have to let go of the world wholesale. And what I think a lot of people do is they want to let go. They found that their desires are dangerous to them. They're troubling to them. They want to be done with them. Okay, and so they want to die to their sins and their desires, but they don't want to die to their anxieties and their, you know. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, look, you don't get to audit this. You don't get, death is it's a zero-sum game. You know, if you died to your concerns over this thing, but you've also died to its appeal, right, or vice versa. However it is that you want to handle it, but there's that part of us that wants to retain enough control, and death is kind of a total relinquishment, not just a part of it. You know, we don't get to just die to things A, B, and C. It kind of makes me think of the movie Click with Adam Sandler. I don't know if you ever saw that.
But I don't remember it.
Yeah, so he gets this universal remote, and it controls the universe, his universe. So there are certain things in life that he really enjoys and he wants to be a part of, but things that he doesn't like, he can fast forward, you know, and the only buttons that work on it are like pause and fast forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's something that he really cares about or likes, he can pause it for a minute. You know, if it's something he really hates, he can fast forward. Well, he ends up just fast forwarding you know, his whole life. But all that to say is he, you know, he's auditing certain things, but yep. in doing that, he loses everything. Anyway, and I think that what we want out of the gospel is we want Jesus to come and make us strong enough to avoid temptation, but also leave us fully alive and running the thing, running the show. Mm-hmm. And Paul's saying, you don't get to do that. You know, you have to die both to these sins, but you must also die to your old way of countering sin, or the world's way of countering sin, human commands. Okay. And so he's saying, seek the things that are above, where, you know, you'll appear with him in glory. Now, verses, what, 5 through about, oh, we'll go through, but this is, we're talking about personal, the personal ethics. So let's just go through verse 10. You want to read 5 through 10?
Okay. So he has said, we died with Christ, we're raised with Christ. Verse 5, put to death, therefore, whatever in you is earthly, sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which is idolatry. On account of these, the wrath of God is coming on those who are disobedient. These are the ways you also once followed when you were living that life. But now you must get rid of all such things: anger, wrath, malice, slander, and abusive language from your mouth. Do not lie to one another, seeing that you have stripped off the old self with its practices and have clothed yourself with the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge according to the image of its creator. In that renewal, there is no longer Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, enslaved and free, but Christ is all and in all. Therefore, as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience. Bear with one another, and if anyone has a complaint against another, forgive each other. Just as the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive. Above all, clothe yourselves with love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. And let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called in one body. And be thankful. Let the word of Christ. Okay, good.
Yep. Yeah. So really, I think in verses 5 through 10, he's talking about the individual. And then in verse 11 through 16, he's talking about the church. Okay. But they're all an ethic, right? But I think that there's a nuance to this ethic. Okay. So I've written down a few of what I would say as Paul's gospel, facets to Paul's gospel ethic. Okay, one is like the expediency ethic, like you were redeemed for X, don't engage in Y. Mm-hmm. Okay, so where Paul says everything is lawful, but not everything is helpful, mm-hmm. right? Another is maybe the freedom ethic. He's saying, look, you were set free, but if you engage in these lustful activities and in sin, you will be enslaved. Okay, the other might be the body ethic. You're part of the body, so don't make the body, you know, a part of this activity that you're doing. Another might be the kingdom ethic, this idea that a new world is breaking in and we are citizens of it and we need to be participants in the new world as it's coming. Okay. Another might be the consecration ethic. You were rescued out of X, so don't do X, but do Y. You know, you were rescued from X for Y, so do Y and not X. Identity, consistency ethic. Because you are X, Y, and Z, you need to do what is appropriate for your station. Mm-hmm. Okay. The other would be maybe circumstances / a sovereignty ethic. This has to do with where Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 says, let everyone remain in the station in which they were called. Mm-hmm. Right. So God called you as this, you can stay there. Right. And then the divine guest would be another one. And there are probably a lot more, but this one is where you are a host for the Holy Spirit. Don't grieve the Holy Spirit through your behavior. Mm-hmm. Live consistent with the Spirit who's now in you. Mm-hmm. So, okay. And what all of those, and again, those are just facets, but that's an approach. And I think we see some of them here. One of them, I think, would be, let me go back and take a look at my reference. Very much like this consecration ethic, this idea that you were redeemed from X for Y, you know. So he's saying you've died to the world. So Paul would say, and I guess you could say this is a rider on the gospel, if we are redeemed from the world, okay? Mm-hmm. So if, rather than preaching that you are redeemed from hell or guilt, but if we say, well, you're redeemed out of a world system. Mm-hmm. So part of that is we must reject legalism. If we're redeemed from a world system,
legalism is part of the world system.
Right, right. But the other part of it is that we must reject lust, things that come. And so that would be a part of this narrative that, now remember, and this is from a while back, and I recommend that you read the book. We haven't plugged that much, but if you haven't read the book yet,
Nathan's
you should
book.
Read the book. Yeah.
Essential Faith.
Essential Faith, that's what it's called. Anyway, so there are really two components to what we've been saved from. Paul says, be saved or save yourself from this corrupt generation. Okay. So there's the generation and then there's the corruption. and those are two things that when you put them together, they make up the world from which we've been saved. So we have to be saved from the generation. By that, I mean our society and its attempts to control us, which is why we can't surrender to law. Okay. But we've also been set free from this corrupting influence within us. So the narrative is that every person is infected with this sin germ, okay? And sin is, we could say that law is a diagnostic tool, that when law is applied to sin, that sin will flare, right? It will reveal itself in a major flare-up. Every time the law is applied to sin, you have a flare-up, okay? Now, how do you begin as a doctor? Now we've identified you have sin. You have a sin problem in your flesh, okay? And we identify that because we applied law to it. And now law has caused a flare-up. So as we are good physicians and we want to see you well, we're going to not do that anymore. And you're like, well, thank you, you know? So, you know, it's like, we've discovered that you're allergic to milk. So we're going to tell you to stop drinking milk, mm-hmm. right? That's the first one. If we say, well, you know, you probably should just keep drinking milk, you know, and you'll probably die. But, and that's what Paul's saying. He's saying, look, the first thing we've got to do is we've got to get rid of the law, okay? Mm-hmm. Because it's causing these flare-ups. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't save. And in fact, it makes matters worse.
Exactly.
Because of how sin reacts to it.
Right, right. Now, it doesn't mean that the law is bad. And Paul makes that point. Just like, say, the milk is not bad or whatever, mm-hmm. right? But it means that whatever's in me is so disordered that law is now revealing it, but it's also causing me harm. Every one of these flare-ups leaves me worse off than I was before. So we have to get rid of the law to get rid of the flare-ups, but then we have to also deal with the sin problem, right? The sin in the flesh. And so that issue is dealt with through a different kind of therapy, let's say, mm-hmm. you know, and this other kind of therapy has to do with, well, let's just say that this condition you have is terminal, and it's so bad that let's just say it's a parasite or whatever. And as long as you are living, this parasite's going to keep growing. So we're gonna have to kill you, mm-hmm. you know. And the parasite will die, and then we'll bring you back, mm-hmm. you know. And so that's the thing. But if you picked up that parasite, let's say you picked up that parasite through some, you know, going someplace mm-hmm. or doing something, should you go back there? You know,
right.
We put you through this extreme therapy and now you've left it behind. Mm-hmm. Should you go back there? Obviously not, you know?
Right.
And so Paul's just saying, look, you've died to that. Don't go back there. Mm-hmm. You know what's down that road.
Right.
So it should be obvious to all of us. It's not, again, it's this ethic of sanctification. You've been cleansed in a very pronounced way at a very high cost. But there's also this matter of expediency that if you continue to do these things, they're going to have the same corrosive effect on your life. And so he tells us, you died to that. Why go back? You know? And not only that, but he's saying, look, when we preached the gospel to you, we told you, we pointed to you to society and we said, look around. Does this look like something that should be like this? Is this the way things should be? And you agreed that it shouldn't. Mm-hmm. And you were a participant in it. And we told you, you can get out of it. You don't have to be in this swell, in this press. You can be pulled out and above it And here's how. And you accepted that, right? Now, why are you getting back into it? And that's what Paul's saying. And the irony is, the insidious thing is that they were being dragged back into that mire by law, by this moral code. And he's saying, look, your attempts to transcend the mire that you tried to escape have put you back into it. That's why he's saying it's of no value against indulgence to the flesh. And so this call is to die to these things, to leave them behind. Now, part of leaving them behind is to give them no mind. You know? And we know whatever you resist persists. If all let's say I've had a porn addiction, and this unfortunately is very common in our society and is very available. And avoiding porn becomes everything for me. You know, then I've got the filters on, I've got an accountability partner and all of this. Am I free of porn?
You're like obsessed with it.
Right. So even if I don't watch it for 6 months, even if I don't watch it for a year, even if you give me a chip and say, hey, good job, you didn't watch porn for a year. Mm-hmm. And I carry that, I put that on my wall. Right. Now, people may come at me for this, but I'm just saying that the recovery mentality keeps the person always connected to their addiction. It says, you are a porn addict. Mm-hmm. You know, and here's another chip. Good job. And your life and your accomplishments and your achievement become about avoiding a thing. Does that sound like you're dead to it?
Mm-mm.
You're very much alive to it.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the not performing it. Mm-hmm. Even in the not going there. And sadly, it does become, it does stand in for morality, ethics. You know, whatever else I may be, you know, I'm 2 years porn free. Yeah. If I want to really look at other people's, I really like to have those people who are still using porn around. I want those people around because they really make me relatively righteous. You know, I may be. You know,
I may be a lot of things, but at least I don't look at porn.
That's it. Yeah. And that's the thing, mm-hmm. right? That becomes the thing. And you see how that approach, it doesn't make somebody free. It really just enslaves them. And they honestly, on a global scale, they're probably indulgent in other ways just because they are just dealing with it a la carte, their sin a la carte. And it just really gives room for other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's saying, look, let's leave that all behind. I think it's important to note, and this isn't the only place where Paul does that, where he will give a list of immoral behaviors. And he will be very clear that God's wrath is on those behaviors. But he does not say, or you will face God's wrath. Because responding to some sort of a moral consequence, again, puts us back into that mode. Okay, he says God's wrath is coming because of these things,
mm-hmm.
right? And says the same thing in 1 Corinthians 6, I think we mentioned last week, but this idea that, you know, he says, look, all of these things you used to be, and God's wrath is coming on the world because of it. But he's mm-hmm. not saying you. He's saying the warning isn't that God is going to punish you for these things. The warning is these things can draw you back into the world, and the world is under God's judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's this matter, are we saved out of the world? We have to retain that. That if we preach a gospel that is salvation from the way of the world,
it's implicit.
We have an ethic built in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it keeps us out of both ditches. It keeps us out of legalism. We can always go back and say, remember, you were saved from the way of the world, like Paul did.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you going to these rules?
Mm-hmm.
Because what's always going to happen when people resort to rules is immorality is going to just build and foment under that surface.
Mm-hmm.
Any legalistic church, you will find the most perverse degradation hiding just under the surface. You know, it's just every time. And so there's a strong warning, really, fighting against legalism is fighting against immorality. They are one and the same. So and so he says, put to death all these things. Now that, you know, because the wrath of God's coming, and then he says, now put on these things, right? Yeah, or he says, further, rid yourself of this, this, this. But all of this is rooted not in and or else, but because of. He's saying this is now who you are. And that gets to that identity, what's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's rooted in the death and resurrection that we're participating in. Mm-hmm. Verse 5, put to death, therefore. So yes. He's talked about how Christ died and you died with Christ. Christ rose and you rose with Christ. And mm-hmm. then our ethic follows from that. Therefore, put to death these sinful ways.
Right.
And then, you know, welcome, put on these godly loving things. Mm-hmm. Verse 12, as God's chosen ones, this is identity. As God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, clothe yourselves yes. with that kind of life.
Right, right. And so, and notice that there's this, he says, you've taken off the old self and you put on the new self that's being renewed in knowledge. And here, in verse 11, notice he's, that sounds like a change of place, mm-hmm. you know? And so it's really learning to contextualize yourself to a new environment, become acclimated, and this gets to that kingdom ethic, you know? And I think that it's not for nothing that he says, here there is no Jew or Gentile or Jew. Why do you think he's bringing that up, right? I think it has to do with back in chapter 2, because those rules begin to create this divide. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, no, you're in a new place, mm-hmm. you know, and in this place, you know, what does that say with the way we engage in our society, the way we build our churches, you know, this kingdom ethic, I think, is where he's really trying to get us to. And so it's not like there's a strong break between 10 and 11. 10 and 11 seems to be much more, or 5 through 10 seems to be much more negative, die to these things, much more personal, right? Mm-hmm. Greed, idolatry, these are all things within the human heart. Beginning in verse 11, he's saying, here, there is no Jew. So he really changes from this sanctification ethic and an identity ethic to a kingdom ethic. That this responsibility that we have to live here, and here being the church, right? It's the kingdom ethic. It's connected to the sanctification ethic, because the church is the called out, but we are called out together. Now this new ethic, it turns very positive, but the positive ethic really begins to drive home this idea of how we relate to each other, how we treat one another. It's like, as an individual, leave that stuff at the door so that you can begin to engage together mm-hmm. as a holy people.
Mm-hmm. Well, this goes back to we're saved out of sinful society in order to be a holy society, God's people.
Right, right. And so there's a culture to this kingdom, but it's rooted in the individual transformation. Because you've been transformed as an individual, now you can come into this kingdom freely participating, right? But, you know, I would just, and this is why I think that this is so important, because as the church has gone through the various years and eras and epochs and emphases, we've been guilty of a lot of things, and I just mean Christendom, the Christian movement, that are implicitly prohibited by the gospel, but not necessarily wrong according to some certain New Testament or Old Testament passages. You know? And so, for instance, you know, slavery in the 1800s, and Southern churches are preaching in favor of it, and they're like, hey, we're not in favor of slavery, in favor of choice, and, you know, it's like, whatever, mm-hmm. right? It's very hard for us to appreciate that they're using the New Testament, where Paul talks about mm-hmm. slaves, obey your masters. I mean, these are very clear New Testament passages, mm-hmm. you know? And so you would preach that and say, well, these slaves they're not obeying their masters, and these people are encouraging them not to obey their masters, and so they're telling them to violate the New Testament at the peril of their soul. Mm-hmm. Okay? Well, that, but from a new, from the gospel ethic, when it says that these distinctions between people are canceled, mm-hmm. you know, yes, some of those people were still slaves in the sense that that was their socioeconomic reality. Okay. But the truth of the matter is they weren't. So there's no, you know, the racial divides, the gender divides, the socioeconomical divides are obliterated if we go through this transition that is the cross and the empty tomb. Clearly, right? That should be obvious to everybody. You know, death is the great leveler. Mm-hmm. So if we've already been through death, we've already been leveled. What place is there for distinctions in how we treat one another? I mean, James only picks, in the book of James, he only picks like a couple of hills to die on, and really only one specific. There's only one specific issue that I can think of in the church that James deals with, and that was showing favoritism to people in their assembly. Everything else he's speaking generics, right? Count it all joy when you fall in various trials. That's pretty generic, right? Mm-hmm.
The tongue.
Faith and works, right? Yeah, your tongue. But here's a very specific issue. Like this is going on particularly in the church. The other things are just generic and apply to anybody, any mm-hmm. Christian, anywhere. But this is very much like, how dare you? Mm-hmm. You know, where do you get off? Why is James coming at him so hard about this? You know, and he's just like, did you not listen? Did you miss it? And James is using very much that identity ethic because he says, you've just looked into a mirror and forgot what you look like. You know, the mm-hmm. one who hears this perfect law of liberty but isn't changed, it's like somebody looks in a mirror and forgot what he looked like. I mean, that's an identity thing. And Paul's just mm-hmm. like, you know, this is what you are, right? Why are you doing something else? You've forgotten what you look like. And so I think that this idea of the kingdom is there in Colossians 3, okay? Now, I would just going to go one more ethic here, and this has to do with the idea of calling / sovereignty. Like the circumstances you were in is your mission field, okay? Mm-hmm. And so that gets down to Colossians 3:17, where he says, whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God and the Father through him. I had somebody ask me the other day, he was like, well, you know, how do I know what God wants me to do? And all of us, I think, have this as Christians. We're just like, what am I supposed to be doing for God? And I was doing some marriage counseling or pre-marriage counseling with somebody, with a couple. And I'm like, you know, we can get so bogged down on doing the right thing that we just don't do the next thing, mm-hmm. you know, and whatever's right there mm-hmm. is the right thing because it's the next thing. And so this is the beauty of the gospel, is that the gospel can apply to the whatever. Notice that he says, and whatever you do. Mm-hmm. So, and that's why it's threatening, because it applies to how you wash your dishes, right? It applies to what time you go to bed, what time you get up, what you do in your free time.
It gets into our business. Whatever.
It is in the everything, right? Mm-hmm. That what legalism allows you is these zones that are just yours. Mm-hmm. You can compartmentalize. What the gospel does is it takes that away and it says, look, the way you are on your job, the way you are when you're babysitting, the way you are when you're, you know, just hanging out first thing in the morning, all of this is significant. Mm-hmm. And so, unfortunately, every translation that I'm aware of, and maybe the new Revised Standard UE, moves verse 17 down with verse 18, but that's mm-hmm. where it belongs. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, because it's a header for what follows.
It is, right. For some reason, I think because we just want to make sure that our church meetings are in the name of Jesus, mm-hmm. we push it up there with verse 16 that has to do with how we act in our assembly. Mm-hmm. Okay. But verse 17 is very clearly, at least in my mind, an introduction to living the gospel in the mundane. Mm-hmm.
Wives, husbands, children, fathers, masters, slaves, mm-hmm. right? The stations of life, the roles we find ourselves in on a daily basis.
Right, right. And so there's that ethic there that says, you know, if you were called a slave, be a slave for Jesus. You know, if you were called as a free person, if you were called as a single person, if you were called as a married person, because everybody wants to blow up their life. But again, that really gets back to this need to be seen as a Christian sometimes, unfortunately, you know, or to change our externals to the point that everybody, and maybe we recognize ourselves as somehow changed. And Paul's saying, look, this change, it begins inside. Go back to verse, or chapter 3, verse 1, you know, and what flows out of that. But if we're not, you know, if you're called as a dishwasher and you're sure that now you're a Christian and you should leave your dishes like Peter and John and go on the mission field, maybe that's true. Most of the time it's not. Most of the time it is be the best dishwasher anybody's ever seen. You know, wash those dishes for Jesus. Man, I will tell you that there is a blessing and a joy in doing the minutia for Jesus that a lot of people miss and will never find, because they're always thinking, I don't have time for this. God's called me and I have way important work to do. And they're just the worst dishwashers.
Yeah.
And that doesn't do the gospel. That doesn't do the reputation of Christ any favors.
So you're describing an ethic. So we're talking about a law-free gospel, but it's not an ethic-free gospel. So that's the way I heard someone say it. The law-free gospel is not an ethic-free gospel. So God's set law aside, because law can't get us there.
Right.
What gets us there is the death and resurrection of Jesus, and that then also becomes our ethic.
Right. Exactly. And when I get back to this idea that as we proclaim the gospel and as we teach the gospel, and that we have to be trained in the gospel, I guess, or literate in the gospel enough so that we are proclaiming a gospel that has that richness, it's robust enough that we can come back and hold people accountable to it. And so that's, I don't think that's the whole battle, but I think that it's a rider, right, onto this idea. If we say the gospel is our ethic, our gospel had better have enough meat on its bones to do the job that we're looking for it to do.
Yeah, right, right.
And that's my concern, is I think that we're all really the product of frontier revivalism.
With this truncated gospel.
Right.
This is Paul's rich gospel, was why he was able to say, don't you know? Shouldn't you know? Because he's assuming they should know better.
Right.
Based on the message they heard.
Right. Yeah. Because he's already like, and like the Corinthians, right? Where he says, don't you know, shouldn't you know that you, that like they were going to lawsuit with each other. And he says, don't you know that we'll judge angels? It's like, well, I didn't know that, you know. But he's saying, when I came, I came knowing nothing but Christ and him crucified. Like he's saying, I was intentionally very, very focused in my presentation. For 18 months, I taught you one thing. Now he goes, he hears that the church is off the rails, and he's not like, I guess I should have taught you more. No, he's like, you didn't listen. You know, how did you get here? Like, he's holding them to Christ and him crucified and the implications of that message. He's like, you missed it, you know. And so, let's just take just real quickly an example of how they missed it. Okay. So they're going and they're setting up these heroes, right? These teachers. I'm of Paul. I'm of Apollos, right? I follow Christ. And that began to create this division in the church. Okay. Now, what is resident in the gospel that would prohibit that before they began it, that they should have known, right? What do you think? This is your test.
Yeah, so something about, renouncing the world involves renouncing man-pleasing, man-following, and now I follow God, I fear God. I live free from the man-pleasing, man-following way to live.
Right. Excellent, yeah, yeah. I mean, and even Christ. Notice that some of the people said, I follow Christ, and he says, you're wrong too. Well, what? Right? See, there are a lot of people out there who think, well, what we need to do is we need to go back to the Gospels and we need to aggregate a personality and we need to be like that guy, and he's the hero. The problem is that Jesus of Nazareth was never supposed to be our moral exemplar. The Gospels are a wonderful thing, but they introduce us to the person who died for our sins. But Paul says, we used to know him according to the flesh. We know him so like that no longer. He's become the spirit of Christ. He is the spirit of faith and of the resurrection, so that he brings us to God as God's sons. We're not just the friends of God's sons. You know, we're not just the Eddie Haskell or whoever comes over to dinner once in a while and everybody's like, right? We're actually sons. We're actually children. He brings us into a sonship relationship with God the Father. Okay, we're in him. So if he's always in our vision, if Jesus of Nazareth is always out there walking ahead of us in our minds, we've missed it. Okay, because we can't see him. We're in him. You see what I'm saying? Like, I'm not saying that looking at the chosen and seeing that person, because I think we should be compelled by him. But he is an expression of the Spirit of Christ that we ought to be. So we will be a unique expression of the Spirit of Christ, mm-hmm. as he is in us and we are in him. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that to say I am a follower of Christ in the sense that I try to be like Jesus of Nazareth is just the same as saying I'm trying to follow Paul or I'm trying to follow Apollos. Okay. So the gospel, right there in the gospel, this notion of Jesus as having died and risen, he's become the life-giving force behind the new life, you know? But to try to pull that back so that we just make him another moral exemplar, a great teacher or whatever, is an error in and of itself, and it doesn't bring good fruit. So it creates yet another insider-outsider distinction, a tendency that we have to judge each other, comparison, all of this mess. And unfortunately, people often will do that as a part of a revival, a push against easy believism, this truncated gospel, and we say, well, we can't have that. What we need are Christ followers. And so in his steps, the book, right? Mm-hmm. More recently, books like Radical, Crazy Love, other things. I mean, and these are well-intentioned. And I think that people can point to people who've made big sacrifices and done radical things for God. But I don't think it's based in the gospel. I think it's based in an attempt to follow the gospels. So that's just an aside. It's
sort of like hero worship and heroism right. that comes out of that. I'm trying to be heroic.
Mm-hmm. Right. And boy, that can become so dangerous, because as I aspire to be that, and let's say, you know, I just know I have to be like that. And my wife doesn't want to go there. Wow. She's the devil. You know, I can't love her now. I mean, she's like the satanic influence. You know, here's a perfectly good human being who just doesn't see that same vision that I do. But now she's not just somebody who disagrees with me. Man, you can imagine if anybody opposes that vision, they start to deserve whatever horrors you might want to call down on them or whatever, however you might want to be shed of them. They certainly are not redeemable. You know, they're just a liability. I mean, man, is that what we were called to just see people as a liability, the people in our lives, the people closest to us? But that's where it goes. One of the places that it goes. The other place is just a rampant disdain for everybody who's not you or in your immediate sphere. Man, that's not good fruit, you know? And that's why it's so important that we really follow the gospel. And the gospel, I think, will gently lead us. I think the gospel will call us to change our vocation or move somewhere, as God brings those circumstances to bear, as it begins to take more real estate in our life, as we are attentive to the Holy Spirit, it certainly will do that. And what it will do more than that, it will so free us from the things that we're attached to that when we do it, it's not some great sacrifice. Like, look, I'm leaving it all for you, Jesus. Mm-hmm. It's like I left it all for you a long time ago. It's just this is the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't become this heroism. Heroism is left behind.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay, that's a start to help our readers begin to understand what we might mean by saying the gospel is an ethic, contains within itself an ethic. Mm-hmm. We will continue the discussion next week. Thanks, everybody. If you got questions, you can always email us to discussion@recoverfaith.org. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.